Welcome to Practical Dermatology, the podcast. There's no paucity of studies for biologic therapies used to treat psoriatic disease, but there is a limited number of head-to-head trials comparing these agents. So, what's a dermatologist to do? Enter the Network Meta-Analysis, or NMAs.
Network Meta-Analysis is a methodology, statistical methodology, that has emerged over the last number of years as a method to compare medication.
That's Dr. Philip Meese, clinical professor at the University of Washington School of Medicine and director of rheumatology research at the Swedish Medical Center in Seattle. He and Dr. Wolf Henning Bunka recently spoke about the use of NMAs in the psoriatic disease literature. Dr. Bunka is chair of the Division of Dermatology and Venereology at Geneva University Hospital, Switzerland, and full professor at the Department of Pathology and Immunology at Geneva University. They discussed the use of NMAs, potential pitfalls, and the possible long-term contributions of these analyses.
Network meta-analyses are used in many other parts of life as a way of comparing things that are not were not directly compared to each other, say in a study or it uses an anchor, typically the placebo arm of a study, that is common to two or more different studies. And then determines the relative risk, meaning the effectiveness of a treatment as compared to placebo, and then matches or compares those different relative risk to each other. And it depends upon, for a good quality NMA, it depends upon the original study from which the data is derived to be well done, to be representative, and to have a substantial enough patient so that it really teaches us what we want to know about an individual medication. And then through this methodology, it allows us to compare them in a reasonably reliable way. Of course, the gold standard for a comparison of medications would be a head-to-head trial, but these are expensive. That takes a lot of patience to do head-to-head trials. And increasingly, there's a demand not only from clinicians to know about the relative effectiveness of different medications that they're recommending to patients, but also patients themselves are interested in knowing, and some go to the extent of learning about the results of network meta-analyses. And then also, there are many agencies and other government entities, for example, that are interested in comparing products so that they can determine their relative value and whether to pay for them in the marketplace. And so they become increasingly important, and it's very important that they be done reliably.
I have, of course, nothing to add with regard to the definition of what NMAs are and why they are done. I think the interesting part comes when we discuss who should do them, why they should be done, when they should be done, and what their limitations could be. So with regard to what they are, I perfectly agree to everything that Philip has just said. Now, what Philip already said, that the point is that you can close knowledge gaps in a somewhat indirect way. In my domain, psoriasis, we do not depend so much on network meta-analysis because many of the clinically relevant direct comparisons have been done. In psoriatic arthritis, this is much more complicated. And my point of view is to provoke people a little bit. A priori, I would say network meta-analysis should be done, but never published. Who should do network meta-analysis? It should be the companies to decide whether they will embark on a head-to-head trial, because it allows them to estimate, you know, the size of the study, et cetera, et cetera. And then decide on whether this is doable or not. Because in the end, as Philip said, the gold standard will always be the head-to-head trial. Having said so, I agree that economically this is impossible. And of course, there is also a defined number of patients and study sites, et cetera. You cannot possibly do each and every study. However, I think that network meta-analysis could help in defining the crucial head-to-head studies that are feasible so that in the end, we have the crucial head-to-head comparisons. For example, in psoriasis, we can talk about several generations of biologics that represent real progress. And I think this progress deserves to be shown in a head-to-head comparison. So for example, you have to show, and this was done, that IL-17 inhibition is superior to TNF-alpha inhibition in psoriasis, and companies understood that and did that. And I'm sure that before they designed their study, they did these network meta-analyses. So I think these analyses have been done long before they have been published, but the companies understood the gain of knowledge that's in there. And now it's at the expert level, so people like Philip Mies, to communicate what can be stated based on these indirect comparison and where the limitations are. And this depends a lot on the wording, which is why I was in the end very proud to be part of this particular network meta-analysis, because if you read that article, I think that the wording is correct and the limitations of what you can deduce from the data is also respected. This, in my eyes, is very important. And we should perhaps discuss where the limitations are and where you shouldn't push the interpretation even further, because some companies, of course, want to use them to position themselves as the most effective drug whatsoever. So as Philip says, the network meta-analysis can only be as good as the initial original studies, and there much depends on standardized endpoints, for example, and inclusion-exclusion criteria. So if you find studies that are really very similar with regard to those, I think that you need less statistic tricks, so to speak, to analyze them. So methodologically, the more similar the structure of the studies are, the better the network meta-analysis will be. And that is, of course, the beauty in psoriasis of the skin, because the endpoints that are usually used are not so complex. So we have very few composite scores, for example, and there is relative robust consensus on what the primary and the most important secondary endpoint should be. Like, everybody reports PASI 75 and PASI 90 results these days. And even more importantly, this is usually at very comparable time points. So usually after 12 to 16 weeks, the variability of already these aspects is, in my eyes, seems to be much more important in psoriatic arthritis, making the analysis much more complex from the very beginning. And I haven't even talked about inclusion and exclusion criteria.
So there are several points to be added. One is that trials choose different time points as their primary endpoint. So some may use 12 weeks, 16 weeks, 24 weeks, for example. If the primary endpoint is the main point of comparison and the what you have the data on, then that variability is already going to make the comparison more difficult. For example, a drug may have a better chance of achieving a good outcome at 24 weeks than 12 weeks, especially if it's slower acting. And so that's an important example. Different dosages may be used in trials. So if you've got two different doses and one is more optimal than the other, then you have to compare each dose, and that reduces the N that you're evaluating, and then the confidence intervals become larger. Another aspect in psoriatic arthritis, which inflammation of the joints, sometimes spine involvement is included, as well as skin and nail involvement. There's safety. There's the ability of the drug to inhibit structural damage progression, radiographs. So already you have a number of different variables that may vary from trial to trial. And so that creates a limitation. And then furthermore, one of the key things about, especially the newer medicines, is that they appear to be relatively safer. We have fewer in the way of serious infections or opportunistic infections or malignancy, for example. Yet these studies aren't really powered to really capture accurately all the safety data. And so it's a little bit difficult to do a comparison of safety, although one is pulled to do that because patients are so interested in knowing about a relative safety of the different medications that you're offering to them. So despite all these limitations, I still think that there is a place and a value for them. Certainly some of the agencies like NICE in the UK is critically dependent upon these types of indirect analyses to help them make their decisions when they don't have the luxury of having head-to-head trials as have been more common in the psoriasis arena. So that's certainly one. And then again, I come back to the importance of being able in front of a patient to be able to do some relative comparisons of the different outcomes.
You're listening to Practical Dermatology, the podcast. Dr. Philip Mies and Dr. Wolf Henning Boonka are addressing the role of network meta-analysis, or NMA, for the assessment of biologic treatments for psoriatic disease. There are some patients who may accept whatever treatment recommendations their physician offers, but there are others who would appreciate the data available through network meta-analysis.
I would say Philip already pointed out the two major ways of using NMAs. I think for administrative bodies, they are absolutely essential when it comes to pricing, et cetera, et cetera. I understand that. With regard to the patients, I use the data from network meta-analysis, but I try to describe it in a way that I lump things together and I say, well, there is a trend that certain drugs are more effective than others, because in the end, we still do not know how this individual drug will perform in this patient I'm facing here right now. So I can tell him, for me, it's more the wealth of the data, the confidence I have in what is known about the drug that I feel is important to communicate to the patient. Then, and this is why I refer to be a little bit humble when it comes to the interpretation and the conclusions to be drawn from network meta-analysis. You can give a hierarchy. You can say this is number one, two, and three. But if you look at the confidence intervals, more often than not, you have overlapping intervals. So you cannot say that drug A is truly superior to drug B. You can say that there's a trend. Still, you can say that certain, and that is why I talked about generations of biologics, because this is another difference between psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis. Even within the class of TNF-alpha inhibitors, we in psoriasis, we see different profiles. So Enbrel, etanercept is clearly different from adalimumab. This is less so if you look at the psoriatic arthritis domains. So that is what I feel is very important to make patients understand and to make colleagues understand, that you cannot deduce a therapeutic algorithm that you will base on the results of the network analysis. However, you can still say that certain drugs seem to be more effective than others. With regard to safety, I think Philip already pointed out that this is far more difficult. And there, even it's also important to look at things in the long term. And the vast majority of network analysis I'm aware of looks at what we would call induction therapy, so short-term treatment, right? So I think that helps me to tell you, look, you are in the ball, these drugs are all in the same ballpark. We are talking about the Champions League here compared to second rank drugs, where you clearly see a drop in efficacy. For the administrative bodies, you know, if you then do your calculations number needed to treat, and then you ask yourself what would be an appropriate price, you know, the tiny little differences that are statistically there, they are relevant. But what is the clinically relevant difference between two drugs that makes me suggest to the patient that he or she should prefer this over that one? So there are the limitations in my eyes. I feel comfortable to talk about trends and give certain profiles to the drugs. But as we do know, of course, there are so many other aspects. So the intervals of injections, or do you go for injection at all or more all drugs? There's all of these additional aspects that do play a role for the patients. And I think the single most the simplest dimension that can be addressed by network meta-analysis is efficacy. And here again, I think there is a difference between psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis, in as much as we are hitting something like the ceiling now. I mean, we are talking about most patients achieving PASI 90s and PASI 100s. And I think we are not there yet in the arena of psoriatic arthritis. So in terms of efficacy, there's little spread if you look at the more recent, particularly biologics that have been approved for psoriasis or about to be approved for psoriasis.
Already you underlined the key point, which is co-management. It's very important for me to have a collegial and very open and conversation with my colleagues in my region that are referring patients to me from the dermatology world. And there are all these nuances about care, choice of medicines, educating the patient about their disease status and its potential for progression. What's the potential for getting various clinical domains into remission? All of these aspects of the conversation that need to come from both the dermatologist and the rheumatologist practices. And when I use the word practice, what I'm implying there is that not only from the physician, but also from the mid-levels that maybe the physician may be working with, such as nurse practitioners or others, as well as the staff that's communicating and fielding questions about safety issues, or is it safe for me to get the COVID vaccination in the context of being on? These are all questions that are important for the two different disciplines to coordinate on. In my setting, we do it virtually because the dermatologist office is separate from the rheumatologist office. But in some settings and in some academic centers, they work together in the same, seeing the patient at the same time, which I think is very ideal, especially for teaching purposes.
I would like to add maybe an aspect that is particularly related to the role of network meta-analysis. I think NMAs are still a very catchy way to transport information. It's very much processed already, so it's far away from the original data. But it puts a lot of information, a lot of relevant information in the context and makes things relatively understandable. You know, we have to trust the network meta-analysis, but we discussed what can be done to make them solid. I find such publications very important to discuss issues with the rheumatologists, and the rheumatologists here at Assurge, they also like to discuss these newer NMAs with me to come to terms. For me, for example, this particular network meta-analysis was so important because in the end, I have a solid document that shows that IL-23 inhibition works in psoriatic arthritis. Why is this important? Because IL-23 inhibition works wonderfully on the skin. So I need arguments to convince the rheumatologist that who hopefully will allow me to treat a patient with skin and joint involvement with an IL-23 inhibitor, because I am deeply convinced that perhaps this patient benefits most from an IL-23 inhibitor. So I have to convince the rheumatologist that this is doable and covers at least some, if not most, of the domains that are relevant for the rheumatologist. So I think there is a high value of network meta-analysis to come to terms and to come to joint decision making in an evidence-based manner, so to speak. And that is a very interesting aspect of these network meta-analysis in my eyes.
As Dr. Meese and Dr. Boonka have noted, NMA analysis can play an important role in helping physicians, patients, and industry compare biologic therapy for psoriatic disease. But the rigor of such analysis is essential to ensuring significance.
A document known as the PRISMA document that has been published in the Annals of Internal Medicine. I have a copy of it around here since I've been referring to it recently in these discussions. And it lays out the optimal methodology that should be used and should be transparently articulated in an NMA analysis that is published. One of the things that I'm happy about this recent publication of the NMA that was conducted by Janssen is that in addition to the main article, they have a supplement that goes on and on and on with all of these league tables and data about the studies from which the calculations were drawn, limitations, really very specific about time intervals that were looked at, and so on and so forth. So what I really like about it is the comprehensiveness to which it is adhered to the PRISMA recommendations for doing a good quality NMA. And so I think it sets a standard for looking for that kind of documentation in other NMAs that are published.
I agree. And that is also why you may guess that I'm a little bit skeptic about the practical use of NMAs. But I was very proud to be part of this particular one because I think this is very rigorously done. However, I think that for the average reader, these are aspects that cannot be appreciated. This is really up to the reviewers to make sure that the network meta-analysis that make it into journals meet the statistical standards, and it has to be statisticians who have a very close look at it and say, this is good. And then it's up to us, the medical authors amongst the many names that you usually find on these network meta-analysis, to come up with reasonable, and by reasonable, I mean, are very careful and conservative wording, in order to not overly push the limits of what you can in the end conclude, despite all your honesty when it comes to processing the data. So I think this is something in the background, and it's the journals who have to make sure that they have highly qualified reviewers who can do that task properly.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Practical Dermatology, the podcast. You can find future editions at practicaldermatology.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.